guys, we are back. We are officially here reporting for duty. It's me, Kathleen. I'm here with Ellie post her gorgeous go on holiday. How are you?
I know. I mean, the listeners probably like, we heard from you last week, guys. Whereas for us, it feels like we've been gone for weeks.
A lifetime.
Because I have not been in the country for 10 days.
I know, which is probably the longest we haven't seen each other literally since March when I went away.
Oh, yes. No, that's
true. Yeah.
I have been traveling for 26 hours today. So I'm really hoping my Mojo coffee from Nootropics keeps me alive and kicking
pep in your step
for the next few hours. But my trip to Goa.
Yes, can you tell me everything? How was it? How was being chased by rabid dogs?
Oh my God. So guys, for anyone that doesn't know, I'm scared of dogs and that has become like a light phobia.
I think you should tell them why. Just give a bit of context.
Oh yeah. So about 10 years ago, I was doing a 10-mile run around my grandparents' house in rural Brittany, and at the end of the run I got lost and ran down a hill into a farm, and I called my dad being like, I'm lost, like, can you come and get me, or can you give me, I can't remember what I was saying. So I was on the phone to my dad when these two farm dogs came yapping around my legs, and I've always loved dogs until that moment, so I didn't think, I was just like not scared of them, but then they started like trying to leap on me. And I'm on the phone to my poor dad, who's probably like, oh my God, is my daughter about to get mauled?
Were you screaming?
Yeah.
What kind of dogs were they?
They were like mongrels, like right. unidentifiable. And I started running back up the hill. And bear in mind, I'm exhausted because I've just done 10 miles and it's quite
Sorry,
a steep hill.
I shouldn't laugh, but I have heard this story before.
Yeah. So. And they're fucking chasing me up the hill. I mean, that was a rookie error. You're not meant to run. You're not meant to turn your back and run. But obviously I've never been chased by dogs before. Anyway, so I run to the top of the hill screaming to my dad on the phone, and when I get to the top they bite me on the calf.
Poor thing.
And it was so deep that they couldn't even put stitches.
So they bit you, and then what happened? Did they run away?
Yeah, then they just ran off, but back down to the farm. Then my dad comes 5 minutes later with my sister and my mum in the car, and I just remember my sister going, Daddy, why is there white stuff coming out of Eleanor's leg? And it was fat.
No.
Yeah, because it was like a really deep puncture and then one smaller, less like more shallow one. But we went to the local doctors and he was like, I literally can't stitch this up because it all gets infected. You know, if it's really deep, you've got to let it. And I never saw it. I literally never saw it because I made my mum do all the, I was just so squeamish. I don't know why. But then I was really upset because I couldn't go on this like trip with my friends. I had to go to the London Hospital of Tropical Diseases because we couldn't identify the dogs, whether they'd been imported. Because I just.
God, what a drama.
Yeah. So I had to get a rabies jab.
Well, very fair that you now have a fear of dogs, I think, from that. I definitely have PTSD from my dog bite in my hand last year. Yeah,
that was really bad.
But I get super nervous now when I'm walking off. If there's any like hint of confrontation, my heart literally starts pounding, my hands sweat. Like, I cannot handle it. I have to literally like walk away.
It's like a physical thing.
Yes, a physical reaction.
And then it was compounded by the fact that when I went to Bali a few years ago, we got chased by clearly a stray dog that looked very unwell. Barking, like he was like yapping an inch away from my leg. And I was so, thank God I was there with a friend who was like, just do not run, just walk calmly. And then I had the most physical reaction I've ever had, but when we got to our hostel like 4 minutes down the road, I collapsed, like onto the lawn. Anyway, so which is all to say that walking around Goa, where there are maybe like, there's something like 66 million stray dogs in India. Have I just completely made that up?
No, that sounds right. My brother has said this to me before. There's like billions in the world. Like there's like literally a crazy amount of stray dogs globally.
There's 62, I just had a quick Google, 62 million stray dogs in India. And rabies is a massive issue.
Let's not focus too much on the trauma. I want to hear all about the best parts. Yes. You loved it. You said to me off air that it's one of the best holidays you've had in ages.
It was. I loved it. Goa is so beautiful. So for people that don't know, it's right at the bottom, the very southern point of India. People say it's like India light.
Yeah.
You've been to India proper. I just couldn't in 10 days do India proper and I just needed to lie down.
No, you needed a holiday.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, we moved around every day. We stayed at like ridiculous amount of hotels because we went from north to south. So I recommend spending a few days in north. I stayed, Kath, as you'll be shocked to know, at a yoga retreat.
I'm very shocked. That's so unlike you.
I know, because obviously you've kind of got to in Goa.
That's the thing
yoga. So we stayed at Ashayanya Yoga Retreat, which I actually loved. They had this, they had no Wi-Fi in the rooms because they wanted people to like come out of their rooms and like congregate in the communal areas, which I thought was actually a really good thing. They changed it last year because they noticed that everyone was just like otherwise in their rooms on their phones the whole time. And what's so lovely is it's loads of single women or like women who've like lost their husbands or like women who've gone through something. And you sit at communal tables and you all eat together and there's like a whole timetable of stuff that you can do throughout the day.
So is it like an ashram?
No, no, it's more informal than that. You can go for as many days as you want. I think you are recommended to go for a week. I only went for a night, which was enough for me. I'm just not a yogi. So I did do one yoga and my favorite bit was the, what do you
call it? Oh, when you lie down at the end.
Yes,
yes,
you lie down
at the end. I do like that bit.
That perfectly is, still yeah. And fall asleep.
A nice relaxing yes. Part.
But I loved meeting all these amazing women. And I also did a Osho meditation. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
Osho was firmly believed, I think it's a man, who believed in a kind of meditation where you're very active in it and you constantly do at certain like...
So it's all like breath work along with the meditation. Yeah.
And you like do it at intervals and then you try and then it goes to an ear and it's like for like half an hour. And I found it so entrancing that I fell asleep immediately. Nice. Because everyone doing this like quite like, I don't know, reassuring sound all together. It's like so safe. And they give you blankets.
Probably reminiscent of a sound bath.
I think it probably was like that, yeah. So that was great.
Yes, because I wanted to tell you, I recently did a crystal healing while you were away, which was amazing. So I was a little bit, well, not skeptical, but I'm obviously into alternative stuff, but crystals I've never been like hugely into. Like I like the look of them, but I've always been like, do they really have these like magical properties? And oh my God, it was just unreal. I came out of it a true convert. So guys, if anyone's listening, go and do a crystal
healing.
Did you
feel like your chakras were aligned?
Yes. And I felt like really good after it for like weeks.
Well done, babe. Weeks.
Well, yes, like 2 weeks or whatever.
Like that is very much worth the money.
Yeah, really good. And your job afterwards is just kind of like keep everything open and aligned and like make sure you are like channeling. Like, for example, one of the things she said to me was you clearly have a lot of like energy and passion and fire, but you probably channel that into the wrong places quite often, as we obviously all do. So just your job now moving forward is to just remind yourself to channel that energy into your work and into creativity and passion rather than
back into yourself in a negative way.
Exactly.
Well, that's why the sound thing is good, because you're essentially expelling stress through your voice, through that.
Yeah. And those sounds, you know, like the reason a gong bath works, because I've done a gong bath before and I didn't love it because I just found it really hard to focus. But what that actually does on a vibrational level is it's about the, like, because we're mostly made up of water, right? So those vibrations from the sounds literally do change our like physiological makeup on a vibrational level.
Yeah.
Like you feel the vibrations like within your whole body because we're made of water. It's quite mad.
Also at the beginning of that is mad. Also at the beginning of the meditation, they were like, the teacher was like, okay, I'm gonna put on some music and just go and dance with anyone, like anyone that you don't know, go and partner with them and just dance. One of you has to do a funny dance and the other person has to copy it. My partner was looked about 85, 87. He's the guy who I was telling you about, told me that when he saw me in yoga, he could see I had the same flexibility issues as him.
Oh my God, that's actually so
like,
funny.
Excuse you, you're literally ancient. Anyway, so we had to dance together, which was so cute. And then the tutor was like, now stare into each other's eyes with a look of, it was something like, with a look of gentle kindness. And we had to do that for a whole minute. It was really hard.
So how did you do a soft and gentle gaze? Can I have a little taste
it? It was actually really hard. I think it was something like...
Okay, guys. So Ellie's looking at me like... So like a head teacher that's like, now you know you're in trouble.
I can't do it in this moment. But it was really moving, looking into the eyes of an old man.
Oh,
it got me really emotional, yeah. Anyway, so that was lovely. The whole place was gorgeous. I really recommend. Then... I moved down to the south, which I way preferred to the north, actually, because it's just like a lot more like desert island beach chill vibes. Nice. Everything's cleaner.
Is it more of a holiday destination, you'd say?
You feel like you're in paradise. So this was by far my favorite hotel, Cabo Sarai in Canongwinnum, would recommend if you're planning a honeymoon, Cathars.
Oh.
They very kindly hosted me. But I would say, having looked at the prices, it's actually quite affordable if you're thinking of doing like a mix and match, choosing some places that are like 20 quid a night like we did. It's still like a 3-star hotel, but I feel like in somewhere like Goa, it still looks amazing.
Yeah.
So it was in a tree house. So every morning I woke up and heard these like amazing birds. I got so into bird watching and bird listening. I recorded like a voice note of all the different birds, which I loved. And they organized like a dinner on the beach. They had amazing massages on our roof terrace among like in the tree canopy, hearing all these incredible birds.
So I think you should mention to the honeys that don't know that you went on this trip with a friend.
I did.
A gal pal.
I go to all my most romantic destinations with my best friends. This is always like, hello.
And was it great for gal pals as much as it would be for couples?
As we always say, put as much energy and care and love into your friendships as with your couples.
Okay, so what was your absolute favourite part of the whole trip? What is an unmissable Goa experience for any honeys who might be planning trips?
I did absolutely love going on a jungle trek with a guide who was just incredible. And then the last two hotels that I recommend very quickly, I would recommend staying at near Palalem at Nagonda beaches because they're beautiful. Stay in Taria Villa, which is a lovely guest house. Amazing breakfast, like hammocks, like swinging in the courtyard. Very peaceful. And then Silver Heritage in Benalim, which is a 350-year-old colonial mansion, but owned by Indian people, which have these amazing Indian weddings. Like the grounds are incredible, beautiful birds, incredible spa.
Well, it sounds lovely.
Thank you, babe. It was fab. Really recommend. If anyone needs more information, I am happy to give it.
Okay, so while you're away, I went to Devon for a weekend, which was lovely. Obviously, much closer to home, but definitely highly, highly, highly recommend The Pig in Coombe for anyone that wants a gorgeous staycation. I have wanted to go to The Pig for like a million years, and it was my belated birthday present, and it was stunning.
From Marlon.
You've been, haven't you? Which one did you go to?
New Forest.
Yeah.
The pics of you and Marlon on Instagram were so cute.
Yeah, we had literally the great time.
The open roaring fire, yeah. The sofas. Did you read on the sofa?
No, me and Marlon never read when we go away because we just chat too much. Like we had too much of a good time together to like do anything separately. Like we just literally talk from like the minute we get there to like, even in the car, like we wanted to listen to a podcast on the way down or on the way back and we just didn't because we just couldn't stop chatting.
That is so cute. Guys, can you tell they're getting married?
Yes.
Let's listen to this in 30 years.
Yeah, when we like literally run out of things to say. Yeah. Although to be fair, it is quite extraordinary now that we're like, wow, we've been together 10 years and we still haven't run out of like things to say.
That is really good.
Yeah. Right, that's quite enough about our various travels. We'll update you with lots of cultural recos very soon. But this week, we're doing something a little bit different, aren't we, Anne?
By popular demand, because of the wild success of our Britney Spears episode, we are going to focus on some other It Girls from the noughties.
Yep, noughties It Girls today. And as you can see from the headline, we are starting with the biggest and most well-known.
Yep, Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton. Guys, if you want to get like the first few years before this, really do go and listen to our Britney episode because it starts with like the 1990s, the late 1990s, which are really important, I think, for how the whole media operates around this time.
Yeah, and one of the big inspirations for this episode was actually the picture that the New York Post ran in 2006, if you guys recall, the Bimbo Summit.
Such a awful but quite funny headline.
Which was paparazzi photos of Hollywood's most controversial It Girls, which at the time were Paris Hilton, Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan.
So this picture is important because not only does it center the gals that we'll be talking about in this episode, but secondly, it is so pivotal in terms of just thinking about the paparazzi, the media, privacy, women in the public eye, our obsession with feuding women, our obsession with successful women in the noughties specifically. It felt like a melting point of all these themes and frictions.
I mean, I think what's interesting about the very nasty angle with Bimbo Summit, it speaks so much to how in the early 2000s, there was this infatuation with young stardom and 24/7 tabloid gossip, but equally they always wanted to tear famous young women down.
Yes. And so a subhead on that spread goes, no clue, no cares, no underwear. Which is very relevant to the fact that that whole decade was often described as the upskirt decade.
Oh yeah, so guys, just FYI, if you can't picture the image we're discussing, it was taken just hours before dawn when the three women were crammed in the front seat of Hilton's Mercedes-Benz SLR McLaren, looking quite sort of reckless and unbothered, and it just really rubbed people up the wrong way, I suppose, didn't it?
Yes, and the picture was also interesting because it was really summing up the feud that the media had created between Paris and Lindsay.
Well, feuds were a huge part of this era, which we're going to get into.
Yes. I think let's first contextualize this decade with a little background on the paparazzi, because they are essentially the glue that holds all these disparate stories and scandals together. I think the stories of Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton literally wouldn't really exist without the paps.
No.
And it was really interesting doing research for this and realizing actually how much like actual editorial was got from them speaking to the paps like they would an interviewer.
Yeah.
Like so many of the major, like the paps actually got stories in a way that news reporters do.
Okay guys, so hopefully you already know this, but here at Straight Up, we actually reach out to every single sponsor that we work with all ourselves, meaning that when you hear a recommendation like this one, we have cherry picked the brand based on products that we already use and really, really want to share with you all. Also with a discount code, of course.
Yeah, we would never advertise something that we don't already love. And Adaptogenic Coffee has been perhaps our favorite discovery of the past year. It took trying a few different brands, but since we found London Nootropics, we've never looked back. They're three different, very tasty blends, all boost brain health while actively and noticeably helping with focus, reducing anxiety, boosting energy, memory, and more.
So just to explain adaptogens and nootropics a little bit, they are natural ingredients like medicinal mushrooms that really improve mental well-being and change how you feel when you consume them. London Nootropics Zen Blend, for example, which is their most balancing blend, contains award-winning ashwagandha in the highest concentration, as well as premium CBD. It is the absolute dream for when you're feeling stressed. The adaptogens in all the blends, actually, by the way, as well, counteract the usual jitters and crashes that you might get from regular coffee. Zen, though, is particularly soothing. I always get really quite anxious the morning after drinking alcohol, but a sachet of Zen now sorts me right out.
It really does make you feel so alert, calm, and focused. I have to say, I was a bit skeptical before actually trying adaptogens myself, but now I cannot imagine starting the morning without a cup of London Nootropics Adaptogenic Coffee. We can't wait to hear what you will think as well. Head to londonnootropics.co.uk and enter the code straight up at the checkout for 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps. So obviously the paparazzi had been around for decades, but in the 1990s, after Diana's death, she died after having been chased by paparazzi in Paris. And so there was this massive kind of tonal change after that, with people being very anxious about how much power the paparazzi had and reasonable expectation of privacy. However, after Diana's death was probably when the paparazzi got their most powerful. Because Us Weekly went from monthly to weekly and started a kind of head-to-head war with People magazine. So there was this constant rivalry between these two weekly magazines, and they would often essentially pay huge sums for paparazzi because there was a bidding war between the two publications, which is why, for instance, that Bimbo Summit picture was sold for $20,000.
To the New York Post.
Insane. And then other celebrity magazines launched, In Touch Weekly, Life and Style Weekly, also within those first few years of that decade. Former New York Daily News gossip columnist Ben Widdicombe has said that actually our fascination with celebrity culture and paparazzi pictures of celebrities was could be traced back to the September terror attacks, because 9/11 was so traumatic and gruesome that when we recovered from the shock, editors said, "We need a picture of a beautiful young girl on page 12, and we need to know who she's dating and what party she's going to." Former photo editor Peter Grossman has said that Of Us Weekly, we're spending six figures an issue on pictures during this time, which is insane.
It's crazy the budgets that places used to have, I always find.
Really
shows how different the media landscape is now.
Yeah, exactly. And along with the rise of the paparazzi and how much money there was in these pap shots, there was the rise of the bloggerazzi. So TMZ, Perez Hilton and Gawker all launched in the early 2000s, which were huge because they essentially fueled our fascination with celebrities' day-to-day lives. And there was this whole idea of people want to know about celebrities failing just like us. Essentially, we want to know how they're just like us.
Yeah, it was all about humanizing celebrities, whether that was, and this is not in any way me saying that this is appropriate, but, you know, Heat magazine's like Circle of Shame, looking at people's cellulite on the beach, or whether it's looking inside their fridges. It's all about the mundane, normal details of people's lives. And yes, actually, that's why I think the internet has been so pivotal in changing how we interact with celebrities, because our parasocial relationship has now moved away from those magazines to social media platforms. And exactly, which is exactly why those magazines haven't been able to survive, because if you want to know the mundane of a celebrity's life, you can just go direct to source.
Exactly. And that's why paparazzi don't make anywhere near the amount of money that they used to. But also, as well as just the normal mundane details of celebrities' lives, they wanted to see them fail. They want to see them fall down outside a nightclub, get really drunk, crash their cars.
And think, oh, they're just like us, actually.
Yeah. So Mila Kunis has said that everything was fine until the rise of Perez Hilton. That's what I would credit this industry crumbling on. He was the first person that literally just spread filth. So Perez Hilton, guys, I'm sure you all know, but he was the son of Cuban immigrants who set up this highly toxic blog where he would get pictures from paparazzis and then essentially do his own like grotesque doodles around them in like paint, as in paint the software, often of young women doing embarrassing things.
It was like hypercritical. And yes, I think people really looked, the first time people looked back at Perez Hilton in a new light was when the Free Britney movement started picking up steam a couple of years ago.
Yes.
He had to apologize.
He did. He had to do a whole mea culpa. He was vile. I mean, he put Jennifer Lawrence's nudes on his blog.
Gross.
He said horrendous things about women. He had all these nicknames. Guess who these are? Mushy Farton.
Mish Barton.
Jennifer Maniston.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm now getting what it, right.
Lynn Sanity.
So rude.
Slutty Cyrus.
But it was all meant to be like fun and camp. Like he did it with this edge that was meant to be like, hey, it's not too serious. But actually it was like bitingly awful.
And then Chris beat her down for Chris
Brown. Oh my God.
Yeah. And yeah, he did a mea culpa, but then he got banned from TikTok permanently after doing something awful to Charli D'Amelio. I think he said something really awful about her dad who'd got arrested. It was a whole thing, and that was like very recently, so he was clearly like never actually that repentant. But anyway, back to his height in these early 2000s, he shared a really interesting anecdote about how he got one of his biggest scoops. So his biggest scoop that really set Perez Hilton like up for success was his Brangelina scoop, when Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt started getting together, which meant that Jennifer Aniston, poor girl,
when
was
they
left
met on
in the
that
cold
film Mr. and Mrs. Smith set.
And basically what happened was that at the time all these paps would get these images, so it was images of Brangelina on holiday, they would get these images and then they would send them around to all the editors unwatermarked, and they would create a bidding war. So a magazine that was outbid got into contact with Perez and offered him the photos, because they had them without watermark, because then it would scoop their rival out of the like £1 million that they'd spent on these pictures.
God.
So he published the Brangelina scoop, which meant that then whatever magazine it was, either Us Weekly or People, would have been one of them, couldn't publish their pictures anymore because it'd already been done. And it was all orchestrated by their rival. That's how serious things were.
Wow.
Between like the paps, celebrities and the magazines in that era, which is just wild. And also it's worth saying, guys, that Perez Hilton operating in America with the First Amendment protection is crucial here, because he had total freedom of speech and he wouldn't have been able to do that in Britain without.
Yeah, there's different
suits.
Rules. I think we touched on that in the Britney episode. There are things you can and can't say about people. And I know the rules around like slander are very much looser in the US than they are here.
And the paparazzi are so important in this decade to these stars that it's really interesting to see actually how much of the pop stars' music is about the paps. Like Britney Spears' Piece of Me in 2007, after her mental breakdown, the whole video is about the paparazzi chasing and hunting her down. And Lindsay Lohan's first proper hit, Rumours, again, all about the paps and the tabloids. And it's like mad how like important they were to their daily lives. And of course, as we said before, they would often call the paps themselves, create their own stories, and Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton, as we'll get into, essentially had this entire several year long feud through the paparazzi as their mouthpieces.
I mean, it went on with Paris and Nicole Richie as well. Yeah. It went on with Nicole Richie and Rachel Zoe. Do you remember the iconic stylist at the time? Like, these women would literally feud via tabloid headlines.
Yes.
Wild.
Via talking to the paparazzi after a nightclub when they were pissed out of their minds.
Okay, so shall we begin with perhaps the ultimate it girl, the original influencer, Miss Paris Hilton.
Yes, babe.
So Paris Whitney Hilton was born on the 17th of February 1981 in New York City to Richard and Kathy Hilton. Paris is the oldest of four children, and she has one sister, Nikki, who you will likely know. They were very much on the social scene together as teenagers, and two brothers, Baron and Conrad Hughes Hilton.
What's the age difference?
Nikki's 2 years younger.
Okay. Nikki, so very close in age.
Yeah. And Nikki is now Nikki Hilton Rothschild. So she's married to a Rothschild. Wow. So very much in those billionaire mover and shaker circle still. So this could be like complete rubbish. I've seen it doing the rounds on TikTok, but there are a lot of rumors actually that Nikki's husband is having flagrant affairs constantly, but she's stayed with him because he's a Rothschild and she wants those billions. As I'll get into later, their family are very much Hollywood royalty. Kathy Hilton had been on the scene for a long time in LA, and as a family unit, they're definitely money driven, let's say that. So I think everyone is well aware that Paris and her siblings had a childhood of extreme privilege. Her great-grandfather, Conrad Hilton, founded the world's first international hotel chain. It's actually quite an interesting story because, of course, Paris is always considered as a Hilton heiress, whereas that's not strictly true. All of her wealth, in fact, she's actually made herself. So I'm using air quotes here, of course, but she's one of these, as Forbes might put it, self-made women. So according to Forbes, Paris is worth an estimated $300 million.
And how is that made?
So majority has actually come through her perfume empire, but she has like literally 26 brands. So she has made everything from cookware to petware to clothing to sunglasses. Like, this is a serial entrepreneur. She has made so much money out of her name and been very savvy about how she's used it.
And do you think a lot of that, like merch and stuff, has been her savvy understanding of little catchphrases?
Oh yeah, so I'll get onto that when we talk about the simple life. But she's definitely someone that knows how to kind of capture the zeitgeist. But I think she's just been incredibly clever with all her licensing deals. Mm. And they are a very entrepreneurial family. So just to clarify again on the family's wealth, the family didn't actually stand to inherit massive amounts of money from Conrad Hilton, her great-grandfather, founder of the hotel chain, as you might expect. Mm. Because Conrad, in fact, left a lot of his money to charity, most of it. And his son, Paris's grandfather, ended up contesting the will. And then, in fact, getting shares of the Hilton Hotel post his own father dying. He then, in turn, gave most of his money to charity, as his father had done before him. So there's this kind of misperception that there's been this huge amount of wealth that's gone through the generations through inheritance.
Did Paris literally not get in any of it? Or is it like she only got 10%?
So she hasn't had anything. And she,
really?
Yeah. But what will happen is she will, of course, I guess, inherit money from her parents. So as I say, Kathy and Richard, better known as Rick, actually have an incredibly successful real estate business. So Rick has been very successful in his own right and has a company called Hilton and Highland, which their net worth now as a couple is estimated at $350 million.
Wow. So how did Paris become famous?
The Hiltons moved to New York when Paris was 15, and she very quickly made her debut on the city's social scene. A 1999 profile written about her and Nikki in The New Yorker said, "At 16 and 18, Nikki and Paris Hilton are the littlest socialites in town. Thin, blonde, and well-born, they moved from LA with their parents 3 years ago and are now out and about with the city's most entitled teens." So they were just kind of being photographed at various different clubs, all the hotspots in town, as that suggests, with the other very rich, privileged movers and shakers of New York society.
It was so weird that around that time, going out was almost like a profession in itself. Like, if you just went to the right places on the right evenings, become famous.
But I mean, they were schoolgirls at this time, yeah, which is quite wild. So I feel like accounts from Paris and from her parents vary slightly, in that Paris has spoken at length about how strict her parents were, how she was kind of rebelling against that. Whereas Kathy's narrative has very much been that Paris was an out of control wild child that started clubbing at 13, like against their will, and would sneak out and all the rest of it.
And how was the media treating Paris at this time?
Well, it was this kind of lurid fascination that I think you've already touched on in terms of what people wanted from paparazzi photos. So Kathy has actually said since that they, when they moved to New York, she just didn't realise what would happen. All of a sudden, I think with two girls, attractive and a very famous last name, people just started to come interested. So she name checks, of course, Vanity Fair's Graydon Carter, one of the most famous journalists of his time. And she says people like him would just write 12 pages on them. So they just created this fascination because of their last name, because they were both conventionally kind of attractive, slim, white, blonde. People were just into it.
They wanted to be them.
Yeah, but people also did want to hate on them as well, for sure, I think. I think when it all really picked up, in fact, was after David LaChapelle photographed Paris and Nikki for the September 2000 issue of Vanity Fair. So Hilton was proclaimed New York's leading it girl in 2001. What we all now know, however, in hindsight, is that some very dark stuff happened to Paris between the ages of 16 and 18. So it took decades for her to speak about this publicly. But Paris was, in fact, such a wild child that she has now spoken at length about being sent by her parents to an institution at 16 for rebellious teenagers, which culminated in 11 months at Provo Canyon in Utah, which she says was the worst of all the facilities that she'd been in and out of. And she was abused in horrific ways, emotionally, physically, sexually. It was awful, locked in solitary confinement. I mean, she goes into detail in her book, in her documentary on the same topic. She mentions it in her new series, Paris in Love, which I've been watching recently on Hey You. And what she said basically happened is that two men came into my room at 4:30 in the morning, holding up handcuffs and said, "Do you want to go the easy way or the hard way?" And I had no idea who they were. I thought I was being kidnapped and screamed for my parents. She then goes on to say that she was dragged out of her room by these men and saw her parents standing there crying in the hall. And so realized that her parents were in fact kind of in on this.
So when did she leave that place?
When she was 18, she came back to New York after 11 months there.
And then continued her wild ways.
Exactly that. So that was a kind of brief gap in her socialite CV. Her mother at the time kind of hinted that she'd been moved schools because of a stalker and that she needed to be homeschooled because they had this scary stalker. In fact, it was because she was at this institution for rebellious teens.
And in a way, it starts this whole decades horrible cycle of these young women being sent away to get better.
And treated like they're mentally ill, or there's something wrong with them, or there's a problem.
Yeah.
Like, and being coerced in much similar ways to Britney. You know, she was force-fed pills.
That is grim. And then, of course, Lindsay Lohan went to rehab countless times throughout that whole decade.
And it's women being, I guess, like coerced against their will. And I think what's really interesting with Paris is it's actually that experience that clearly made her decide that she very much wanted to be famous and successful. So she says, while now she completely understands why her parents sent her there, because she knows how much manipulation is done via marketing with these institutions. So they're encouraging, especially privileged people, but the state give them money too, to send their kids there. And they pretend that it's rehabilitative and that it's all like sunshine and roses and horses and rainbows. And in fact, it's like pure abuse. But she doesn't blame her parents now. Then, though, she did hate them for sending them there. And she swore she'd be successful after getting out so she'd never have to be beholden to them. Mm. So to her, success equaled freedom, because she was like, I swear that I'm going to make all my own money. My parents are not going to control me. And it's there she began plotting her fame, because she saw fame as a route to autonomy. It's now, and I'll touch on this later, but she's, of course, a huge advocate for complete reform in this area. It's a $50 billion industry, the troubled teen industry. Do you remember at all knowing about that at the time?
Because not only when we did our last episode on it.
See, in the noughties, I did, because I remember always being afraid of like military school in America. I remember watching reality shows about kids getting sent off to military school. And actually Paris, in her lobbying with, you know, getting certain bills through Congress and stuff, has actually even changed laws in Ireland and England.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cathers, we have many pet peeves that unite us, but I must say one of the most notable has got to be our misophonia, which, as we've recently discovered, is the term used to describe a negative emotional reaction to common sounds.
Oh my God, babe, nothing enrages us quite like the sound of someone troughing at their desk or tapping away violently on their keyboard. for me, as someone that struggles with ADHD, distracting sounds are honestly such an issue when I'm trying to work. I actually can't cope.
Of course. Which is why we're such big fans of the tiny, comfy and super unobtrusive Karma earbuds from our brilliant podcast sponsor, Flare Audio. Kathas, how do they work? Take it away.
Well, huns, our ears are shaped like shells. So the sound we receive is always distorted at about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out. But if like me and Elle's, yours needs a little bit of a helping hand, then the Karma earbuds are just perfect.
Such an upgrade, I have to say, from my noise cancelling headphones, which are very antisocial when you're in the office and a colleague's trying to talk to you and block you off from sounds you actually really need to hear. Don't just take our word for it either, guys. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch of lockdown, and they even do mini versions for kids and a new version called Karma Soft, which is an extra soft option for those with more sensitive ears.
And the extra, extra good news is that Flare Audio has 20% off site-wide right now. It's for Black Friday, so go to flareaudio.com to snap up your Karma earbuds for just $15.96 instead of the usual $19.95.
Thank you so much to Flare. Okay, so how does she start to make her initial millions?
So once she was back in New York, as I said, she was the ultimate it girl. She was being paid to party. So she has said in interview prior before, it all started when I was 16 and first moved to New York City. I just started getting offers to go to different events.
The original PAs.
Exactly. So this was told to Ocean Drive. She then says, all of a sudden, it was like, we're going to pay you $1 million to come to Japan. And my sister and I started going all around to different events and parties. And from there, George Maloof called me. This is a businessman. He said, Paris, I'm opening the new Palms Hotel in Las Vegas, and I would love you to fly down in a jet, and I want you to wear this $1 million dress. It has $1 million worth of Palms gambling chips on it, and I'll pay you to come. She did do it. And after that, she became, as you say, queen of the PA. And she was getting calls every single weekend from clubs in Las Vegas being like, please come and open our club. Please come and have an appearance. And was being offered, like we say, five,
and
six
this
figures
before
for it.
She started DJing.
Yeah, way before she started DJing. And way before she kind of gained global notoriety or celebrity through the simple life.
So would you say it was not only the fact that, of course, she had a kind of celebrity already through her family and she was conventionally attractive for that era, but it was also that she was this incredibly like good time girl. Like when Paris enters a club, things are going to get wild.
I mean, yes, but what I would say is she was definitely courting celebrity and fame in a purposeful way. So Paris had begun pursuing modeling and acting at 19. She was, in fact, signed with Donald Trump's agency, Team Management. Gross. And she was featured in the September 2000 issue of Vanity Fair alongside Nikki. She walked in New York Fashion Week in 2001. So she was kind of being positioned as like a gal about town, like you say, but also in fashion circles.
She's definitely tall enough to be a model.
Exactly. She was in a movie in 2000, Sweetie Pie. And in that time, she actually began talking to TV networks about how she could get onto the television. Coincidentally enough, at the time that Paris began to look around for TV work in the early 2000s, Fox's comedy department had been tasked with coming up with a fresh concept that would hark back to the 60s like comedy sitcom. They had this idea where they were inspired by a former 60s sitcom called Green Acres, which was about a New York society couple who moved to a farm. This kind of all just worked perfectly because it meant that Paris presented herself at exactly the right time to the network. And this is where the simple life kind of started. I think what's really interesting, though, is Paris, I think, was prepared to do it on her own. But Fox wanted her to have a friend or a sidekick. We now think of Nicole Richie as her best friend. And that's why they did the show together, because it was entirely organic. But in fact, it was very much set up and partly by Fox. Paris, I think, initially had suggested Kimberly Stewart, Rod Stewart's daughter, who she is very good friends with, as the secondary person on the show. But for whatever reason, the various people, including Kimberly Stewart, that she reached out to just weren't that interested in being on telly. However, Lionel Richie's adopted daughter, Nicole Richie, a former childhood friend who she'd been to school with in LA, did want to come on it. And with that, The Simple Life was born. So do you remember The Simple Life?
I do, of course. It's where the infamous catchphrase, that's hot.
So the two girls, for those that don't know, would go down to rural parts of America like Arkansas and work on farms. It was very clever because it kind of spoke to the massive class divide and I suppose also geographical divide between like urbanites and rural people in America. And it really unpicked the dynamic in a way that still made the hosts, the rural hosts, seem like the everyday heroes because they could do all these incredible things that Paris and Nicole absolutely couldn't. So they kind of were skewering themselves to a degree on TV.
I think that's why people did why Paris did endear herself to so many people was that she was able to take the piss out of herself in this very controlled, very funny way.
Exactly. And what I think is very interesting, I touched on Kathy Hilton, Paris's mother, earlier, but the first episode of The Simple Life shows a big leaving party for the girls in New York, and Kathy does a big speech in it. It's just very obvious that she wants the limelight. I think that's super interesting. So anyone that has watched The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills will know Kathy Hilton very well. She has been an iconic figure in Hollywood history, I would say, over the last kind of 40 years. So just to rewind a little bit, Paris's grandmother, Big Kathy, aka yeah. Kathleen, funnily enough, was
Kathers to her friends.
Yeah, Big Kath was.
Oh my God, Big Kath.
She was literally called Big Kathy because there's. So just to clarify on the Kaths, Paris Hilton's grandmother is Big Kathy. Her mother is Kathy.
Right, got it.
And Big Kathy was, by all accounts, a pretty awful, awful woman who put incredible pressure on her three daughters, Kathy, Kyle, and Kim, to be child stars. And it's clearly created like intergenerational damage that you can very much see in Kathy and Paris. So
Kathy really put loads of pressure on Paris to be famous.
And to be perfect. And that all comes from their childhood. So if you, again, watch Beverly Hills Housewives, you will have heard Kyle Richards, who's Kathy's sister, Paris's aunt, who's the longest standing cast member, talk about this at length. They touch on it and about how they were these high society figures that had to be perfect all the time. Everything was about money. So Big Kathy had a reputation for marrying men, taking all their money, making them change their wills to write their own kids out of them and stuff, and then like leaving them destitute.
Wow.
Yeah. And she was quite abusive, I think. She drank a lot. She was quite angry. So
she sounds quite patriarchal.
Oh, she's awful. And that's Kathy Hilton's mother. So Kathy Hilton put the most incredible pressure on Paris and her other children to be perfect, to be great representatives for the family, to be famous, to want to be in the spotlight. You know, this was not incidental. Like, Kathy's a child star who had actually been in Bewitched. Kyle was in Little House on the Prairie. Like, Big Kathy had been putting them to work since they were like 2 months old. So Kathy Hilton had grown up in this very starry circle. Like, she was best friends with Michael Jackson from when she was 13.
Wow.
So Paris therefore grew up going on set to every one of Michael Jackson's music videos because Kathy would take him.
Oh God, I hope she was okay.
And as people well know, they also grew up alongside the Kardashians. Kathy Hilton's very good friends with Kris Jenner, and they all kind of grew up alongside each other. Kim went to school with Paris. She was actually hired by Paris in 2006 as a stylist.
Yes, of course.
Then unknown. She featured on The Simple Life.
Would you say that a lot of these mum types who want child stars, they are actually trying to live out a fantasy of their own broken dreams through their child? Did yes. Kathy have a failed career in the limelight? Ultimately?
I would kind of say so. Well, it's not so much that it was failed. She was a child star, I'd say, but she met Rick at about 15 and had Paris, her first child, at 19. So she was very much a mother for like decades from 19. And I think she wanted to live out fame through Paris. So I think she really pushed Paris into TV opportunities, into being a celebrity. She didn't originally want her to be a actress or a model. Really, perhaps because of her own experiences of the industry. But then once Paris began courting celebrity anyway, I think she could see that there was a big fat paycheck coming for the whole family. She also knew that the family's reputation as Hollywood royalty was at stake. Paris has said previously, actually, in interviews, when she talks about Kathy's obsession with appearances and pretending to be perfect, which was very much an issue with Big Kathy's too, "My mum wanted me to be a Hilton. I just wanted to be Paris."
God, that's so sad. But it is such a massive problem when it comes to child stars, isn't it? It's the parents either using their children to get money or to live out this like broken dream fantasy, which is highly relevant to Lindsay Lohan. So her parents were also absolutely terrible when it came to exploiting their child for money and for their own fame. So I will just quickly give you a bit of a background on Lindsay, because
yes, please do.
These women's trajectories really mirrored each other, didn't they?
Oh, totally.
And what's the age difference between them?
Lindsay's 37 and Paris is 42, so a 5-year age gap?
Yes. So Lindsay Lohan's parents are called Michael and Dina, and like Kathy, Dina also was courted fame in her youth. She was one of the Rockettes. And so she was a dancer and she really wanted to be famous. And she met her husband, Michael, in a club. Michael worked on Wall Street and then was sent to federal prison for stock fraud.
Pre or post Lindsay's birth?
post Lindsay's birth, and he constantly is getting arrested for drink driving, for drugs, all throughout Lindsay's adolescence. And their parents clearly have a really violent, awful relationship. Dina accused Michael of raping her, of abusing her. It's like a horrible family to grow up in. But the mum, from the very beginning, Dina, wants to kind of live out her like failed dancing dreams through Lindsay's own fame, because she, like Kathy, met Michael really young and had children, and it seems like she kind of resented that. So in 1998, as we all know, Lindsay Lohan starred in The Parent Trap.
So was The Parent Trap her big break?
It was her big acting break, but her mother had signed her up to Ford Models from the age of three. So she was modeling from the age of three, and by the age of 10, she'd done 60 TV commercials.
Wow.
And she got 100K for The Parent Trap. And
best film ever. I can't believe you haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it, guys. Isn't
that
so weird?
You've got to go away and watch it this weekend. I rewatched it on my friend's hen earlier this year as like a raw throwback, and it was just chef's kiss.
I do want to see it. It's one of those things that, because so many people talked about it, put me off.
Annie and Hallie, the classics. I remember watching it at a sleepover when I was like 10, and we were obsessed. We used to do the handshake. It was like the reason my friend pierced her ears with a needle, trying to copy the girls from what
they
did.
Oh my God.
Oh, it was so good. Oh, was her mum Elizabeth someone? If anyone remembers how hilarious the mother's fashion designs for wedding dresses were, please send me a DM. Let's discuss.
Okay, I'll watch it, hon. So from the get-go, Dina made Lindsay, who was like 11 at this time, sign a contract that made her her manager in perpetuity and get a 20% cut. And now then,
that's so wild that you can make an 11-year-old do that. How can an 11-year-old sign an in perpetuity contract?
Yes. Well, I guess as her guardian, you also make all those kind of decisions anyway.
Yeah.
And then throughout her adolescence, there is this like absolutely disgusting fight between Michael and Dina to get some of their management fees. So Michael then sues Dina to try and get half of the management fees because they eventually divorce. It's just like disgusting how obsessed they are with using their child to get money.
Did Lindsay emancipate herself from her parents?
She was estranged from her dad, but her mum, because she was her manager, was with her all the time. And what was really difficult was that her mum was a big drinker. They would both get wasted together. Her mum would go clubbing with her. She was constantly on the party circuit with Lindsay. And it seems that, I mean, I think there is a lot to be said of addiction being almost learnt in family settings. Like if your parents both abuse alcohol and drugs.
Yeah, like, you're far more likely to suffer from addiction. But also there are neurological reasons that they could be hereditary as well.
Yes. And poor Lindsay was just going through such traumatic things. In 1997, her dad comes to California to come and see Lindsay Lohan film The Parent Trap, which violates his probation because he's been done for fraud, and he's arrested in front of her when she is 11 years old. Oh, like, can you imagine how that must affect you as a child? And so then she becomes estranged from her dad. But then throughout the next decade, he's constantly trying to get a piece of her fame. He is constantly giving TV interviews. He does a TV interview about how Lindsay Lohan was conceived and the different sex positions him and Dina did. He does an interview in 2008 where he submitted a DNA sample for a paternity test, and that's how Lindsay Lohan found out that she had a secret half-sister.
What?
Like, through that. Also, he tried to get Lindsay to do a reality show with him. He had a lawsuit against Dina for half of the management fees for Lindsay, and he said he would drop the lawsuit if Lindsay joined him on a reality show.
So he's like blackmailing her in the public sphere.
Dina, at one point, when she has her own reality TV show with Disney...
I do actually remember this. Now you're saying it's ringing some bells.
She goes with a mic to Lindsay's rehab center to interview her daughter in rehab for her reality show. Like, that is, you can't get more exploitative than that.
Literally. As Paris Hilton would say, that is just beyond.
It's insane. So I think there is this real sense that, like you said with Kathy, the parents are just obsessed with their own limelight.
For sure.
There's one mental moment, and we'll get to this whole like stars getting arrested all the time later, but when Lindsay Lohan gets caught with cocaine and drink driving, her uncle, her sister, her dad, and her mum all give interviews.
Wild.
It's like, anyone else?
Want to jump on in there and take a pop?
Hans, we have the best news for those of you based in London. Okay, how would you like to go to the best fitness classes in the capital for free? Yep, you heard me right, without spending a penny.
It's all so exciting, and it's thanks to our amazing partner Yonder, which, as regular listeners will know, is this incredible lifestyle credit card that allows you to earn points for every pound you spend that you can then redeem at a selection of lifestyle experiences across the city, so from restaurants and bars to shops, hotels, gyms and more.
So what's really fun is that the reward partners change each month, so loads to choose from. This month, they've partnered with boxing club Cobox, which describes itself as where Fight Club meets nightclub. And then there's Boom Cycle, which is apparently a party on a bike. Cathars, that sounds like a bit of us.
And actually, it's a fab thing to do for when you want to swap the pub for something just a little bit more wholesome, but still hang out. So I am defo up for that.
Also, guys, the point system is so good that the other night I went to 45 German Street, one of my favourite restaurants, and I used my points with my boyfriend to get the entire £175 meal for free. Also, guys, good to know, the £15 monthly Yonder card fee includes comprehensive travel insurance. So compared to other credit cards on the market, it feels well worth the money.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner, Yonder. Get your first month free and 10,000 points when you join. Then it's £15 a month thereafter. Please do make sure you borrow responsibly. T's and C's apply. Rep 66.7% APR variable.
When was The Simple Life? So when did that take off?
Yes, so back to The Simple Life. It premiered on the 2nd of December 2003, and it quickly became a TV phenomenon. It was wildly popular. It smashed ratings. The first episode alone that I mentioned before, with Kathy Hilton doing the speech at the going away party, attracted 13 million viewers. I think what was very interesting about the way Paris handled it all is she very much used the show to cultivate her dumb blonde persona, which in turn made her an even more polarizing figure, because a lot of people felt that she was everything wrong with fame, everything wrong with society. She was famous for fame's sake, you know, all that stuff. I think what was interesting, though, is it was quite clear from early on that Paris was definitely the star of The Simple Life, and Paris had appeared in all the marketing materials, and she'd also been the person that had done all the negotiating with Fox. However, just as the show was due to premiere, a sex tape of Paris was leaked by former boyfriend Rick Solomon.
Called One Night in Paris.
Exactly.
Which that. I watched age 14.
I also saw it. I think we've maybe even said this on air before. I saw bits of it because a friend's big brother had it. Obviously didn't understand the problematic nature of the voyeurism there. But it's really, really awful when we look back. And I think there's a big conversational piece on how acceptable it was not only to circulate women's sex tapes, but to publicly bash them for it. In that era, it was a real problem. But
also, we say sex tape, but it's actually revenge porn.
Well, exactly. Sorry. Yeah, that's not even what I mean. Like, that, looking back on it, I'm like, he published a private video without her permission, and it was framed as a salacious sex tape, not literal, like, image-based abuse.
Yeah.
Which I suppose it wasn't then, because the laws have changed.
Of course.
So Rick Solomon clearly wanted to capitalize on Paris's fame as The Simple Life was popping off. He initially had this weird story about the sex tape being leaked by a friend that had found it. There was a very weird thing as well that perhaps speaks to what you mentioned in terms of the paparazzi's obsession with the mundane celebrity being a response in a way culturally to 9/11, in that he dedicated the sex tape to the victims of a 9/11.
What?
How unhinged is that?
Is that trolling?
Very weird. I think he was trying to make it look like it had some kind of social good. So after originally denying that it was him, he then kind of went full circle and sold a longer version of the tape. So the original that went out just at the same time as The Simple Life was a small grainy tape. In the year after, he published like a longer, like uncut 40-minute version, which Paris then sued him over, because he partnered with like a porn distributor to put it out. And you could go and watch it on a website called trustfundgirls.com. So he would do interviews where he would grossly push the audience to trustfundgirls.com to go and pay money to watch this video of Paris. Bear mind as well, can I just say that she was 18 when they filmed the video. He was her first boyfriend, and he definitely manipulated it into it. She's spoken about it since, and she said how awful that experience really was. She says it was like electronically being raped.
Do you think he was inspired by Pamela Anderson's sex tape?
Well, I did wonder this, because I was thinking a lot of that and just how awful that was, that
which
that could
was
be
in
published against her consent.
Yes, because that was 1995.
I think perhaps he was, but I think he also knew that he could make a lot of money out of it. I think he got paid 500,000, something like that, which again at the time was a big deal. Mm. I think what was so difficult for Paris is that people at the time thought she'd leaked it on purpose for publicity due to the timing matching up with The Simple Life, as I say. And I think the public, both the paparazzi and readers, like reveled in this shame that she should feel. And I think that's a really big topic with Britney, as we touched on with the Diane Sawyer interview in our episode about her. You know, the media especially wanted women, young women, to feel shameful about their sexuality, about...
Which is why Kim K, on a very different level, has been quietly, well, not quietly, very revolutionary, because she kind of, her mum did leak the sex tape.
Well, I think that's what's very interesting, again, about proudly, the way that these two families intersect. As I say, they grew up in the same neighbourhoods in Beverly Hills, and Kathy Hilton and Kris Jenner were friends for a long time. And weird thing that I realised doing this research as well is, obviously the Kardashians all have K names, right?
Yeah.
I think Kris Jenner was in fact inspired by Big Kathy, because Kathy Hilton, Paris's mother, there's Kathy with a K, Kyle and Kim. So right. She had all K names.
And Kim, maybe she took Kim as well.
Kris had obviously come from more frugal, humble background, whereas Kathy Hilton was the pinnacle of LA society. Very so Kris Jenner definitely looked up to her at the time. And I think it's been a real sobering thing for the Hiltons, just how things have switched, because the Kardashians were like the trashy ones in this era. As I mentioned, Kim was unknown. She was Paris's
stylist
in 2006. And Kris had been this friend, you know, they'd all be at the tennis club together and stuff like that. And I think that Kris was inspired by what happened with Paris. So the Hiltons were furious. As I mentioned, they're prim, they're proper. They have, the family name is everything. There is no way that Kathy Hilton would have wanted her daughter to have a sex tape out there. There was no way that as parents, they would have allowed that as a kind of publicity move. Mm. So I think it was very much leaked against her will. However, the fact that it brought her so much notoriety and success and fame and really got people talking about her, I think Kris Jenner saw that and was like, right, we need to orchestrate a sex tape. And Ray J has said, you know, since recent years, that it was all very much orchestrated.
Yes, I've read that.
Yeah.
So when that sex tape was leaked, how did Paris react? Did she kind of make the jokes before anyone else could?
So the family employed a crisis comms team, and they cancelled, as in the crisis PR, cancelled all of the promo for The Simple Life that Paris had lined up, and suggested that she just did one piece of press, which was at the time Saturday Night Live with Jimmy Kimmel. So she did that, and there was some in jokes. There was this whole joke about the Paris Hilton, as in there was a Hilton hotel in Paris, and Jimmy Kimmel's making these jokes about, like, is it roomy? Is it hard to get in? But it's tongue in cheek, and you know that Paris is in on the joke. So actually, I personally think that she did quite well with that. You know, she was able to almost keep her head high, given how awful what was happening was, and look a little bit knowing and funny.
Well, that's very interesting, babe, because around that same time, Lindsay Lohan also went on SNL, and similarly to Paris, she was very much the butt of the joke. But I actually don't know how I feel about some of the sketches and whether it's exploitative or whether she's controlling the narrative. And I think that's that whole tension throughout the entire decade is, are they choosing it, or are they being exploited? So in 2004, when Lindsay Lohan is just 17, so Mean Girls had just come out in 2004 also. And it was, interestingly, also the moment where the press swiftly then turned against her, because she'd reached like the pinnacle. She'd done like Freaky Friday.
She needs to be dragged down.
Yeah, she was like commanding like $7.5 million per film. And everyone was like, what? That's way too much for a 17, 18-year-old girl. So on SNL, she has this skit that is genuinely really, really fucked up. And I urge everyone to go and watch it after this. But it's called Hermione's Growth Spurt. And it's all based around the fact that everyone thought that Lindsay Lohan had got breast implants. And if you have listened to Britney's episode, you will remember that that was a theme in the press then as well. Journalists were like obsessed with, did Britney get a boob job? Mm. And it's like, well, even if she did, it's none of your concern. But also, these are young women who are growing up and hitting puberty. And, you know,
their bodies are going to change.
Yeah. So there was a skit called Hermione's Growth Spurt, where Lindsay Lohan plays Hermione, who comes back after the summer break.
As in Hermione from Harry Potter?
Yeah. Right. And she does her British accent, which I think they'd done as well because of the parent chat British accent. And, you know, everyone likes her for that. And then Harry and Ron are like completely out of their minds, can't stop looking at her breasts, which are like in really pushed up in this really low cut top, which is fucking weird when you think about the fact that she's 17.
Yeah, that's deeply inappropriate when in America the age of consent is 18.
Yeah.
And they're so puritanical about things. Again, sorry to our American honeys listening, but I just find it so weird, that dichotomy between like over-sexualization and also like real puritanical like prudism.
Well, there's a sense of, I guess, repression, isn't there? And therefore further obsession. So the whole skit is having all these male characters ogle her breasts and her being like, I'm just trying to concentrate on stopping Voldemort. But then like bouncing up and down and then using a magnifying glass to read a book, which magnifies her breasts. It's deeply disturbing. You're sexualizing a minor. But SNL at that point was headed up by Tina Fey, who'd obviously written Mean Girls and was a mentor to Lindsay at that time. And Lindsay has said that like Tina Fey was really instrumental in helping her like overcome her eating disorder. She had bulimia when her mum basically like dismissed her as melodrama. Her mum actually gave an interview to the press where she said, it's Lindsay's being melodramatic. She doesn't have bulimia. She's just a young girl. That's what they, you know, she's just slim. Like, it's so dark how Dina comments, how the things Dina says to the press, essentially just like negating her daughter's experience, very serious experiences. But when I was watching these skits, I was just like, so is she in on the joke? Is she kind of like making fun of all these like disgusting male journalists who are obsessed with her boobs? Because actually what we're making fun of is Fred, George, Harry and Ron being like lame freaks who seem to have never seen a pair of boobs before. Or is it Lindsay who's being humiliated because like millions of people are watching her breasts like jiggle up and down?
Yeah, I guess we just have a different framework within which to view this kind of thing now. So at the time it might have seemed, oh, it's kind of empowering. And I totally see why Paris made the choice to do that, why Lindsay made the choice to do that.
Written by a woman, Tina Fey.
But in hindsight, I think at 17, like, can you have the emotional maturity and awareness to know whether that's appropriate for you?
Exactly. And I think as well, what it did actually was kind of normalize this whole thing, which I think Paris does as well, of her or of these women always having to make fun of themselves.
For it to be palatable.
For it to be palatable. So every time Lindsay is interviewed, people make fun of her being in rehab, of her alleged breast implant, of her wearing an alcohol monitoring bracelet, of her having crashed a car, all these very serious things. And it's like, ha, 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 to the point where David Letterman makes so many jokes about it when he interviews her that she starts crying. But then even after breaking down in tears, she makes several jokes about like whether her mug of tea has vodka in it and stuff. And it's like this really horrible, like, oh God, she can't stop herself
Stockholm syndrome, constantly making
jokes about, yeah, these really serious things. And she was just crying a second ago. It's like really difficult to know how much of it is controlling the narrative and is just being the butt of the joke.
Well, someone like David Letterman has come under increasingly like intense scrutiny in the last few years, hasn't he? As especially post the Free Britney movement picking up wind, people have looked back at these kind of anchor interviews and just how inappropriately he spoke to very young women on his show.
Yes, terrible.
He did the same to Paris. So she'd been arrested for a DUI and she spent like 40 days in prison, and she'd gone onto his show to talk about, you know, as usual, a perfume launch, a film and something else. And he keeps bringing it up. And she said, I don't really want to talk about it. Like, I'm here to focus on other things. It's in the past. And he just keeps going. And she has to kind of laugh. But it's actually, in hindsight, deeply inappropriate where this young 24-year-old woman has asked you to stop bringing up an incredibly traumatic time in her life, which, can I just say as well, at the time, we won't have known just how triggering being in jail would have been.
Oh my God, yeah.
Post being in the, like,
in solitary confinement,
solitary confinement, where she was put in solitary confinement there as well, and she was in solitary confinement in jail for her own safety.
That is so fucked up.
The way that he dealt with it, you know, women just had to laugh it off. And in fact, now you look back on it and you're like, you are a fucking grown man bullying like teen women.
What's even more disturbing is that Lindsay, after getting very disturbed by his line of questioning and actually saying to him, this wasn't in the pre-interview, and like calling him out on it, she actually says to him, please stop. I've been here since I was 7, referencing like the many times that she's been on his show. I.e., look, like, David, you've seen me grow up, like, can you have some respect. And it just makes you realize like he has no compassion. You've seen this little girl on your show many times and yet you're still humiliating her in this way.
I just cannot believe quite how flagrantly like gross all the men in the media was. So figures that we even know well now, like Piers Morgan said to Paris Hilton that he'd watched What Night in Paris for research purposes.
Oh my God.
Vom, just shut up.
Donald Trump said that he thought Lindsay Lohan would be good in bed.
Oh my God, no.
She was a minor.
And he also said that he watched One Night in Paris. Bear in mind, he's known Paris since she's 12. And said he watched it.
Sorry, Donald Trump?
Yes. Said that he watched it because Melania showed it to him. How bizarre, and like went on this whole thing about it.
Oh,
like, can you imagine?
God.
Absolutely gross. But I think what's quite interesting, and you just touched on Tina Fey, is that with Paris, and I wonder if it was perhaps like this with Lindsay at the time, especially with the Bimbo Summit stuff, it became almost feminist to hate on those women. So a lot of women themselves, there was a lot of internalized misogyny going on. And Tina Fey actually once made comments on Howard Stern about Paris Hilton that when I could not believe what I was reading. I cannot believe the things that she said. So she talks about Paris Hilton being difficult and awful on that particular appearance on Saturday Night Live with Jimmy Kimmel. Tina Fey had, of course, been one of the showrunners at the time. One of the things she even says is, and I quote, Paris Hilton looks like a tranny up close. Like, can you believe that Tina Fey said that? And Tina Fey is meant to be this like feminist figure.
And but, that is a deeply transphobic word.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, that is so unbelievably problematic in so many ways.
Exactly.
To be absolutely clear. Like, you've just literally, like, you couldn't be more offensive with
you've
that
ticked
sentence.
Every box. But you're right, it is women as well as men. Remember when the Framing Britney thing came out, Sarah Silverman at the VMAs, Britney's children are the cutest mistake she's ever made, as cute as a hairless vagina they came out of.
I really don't like Sarah Silverman. Yeah. You know? She did the same to Paris. She made these really damning, like gross jokes about Paris's time in jail, about her sex tape. Not a fan.
So I think it's really interesting what you said about the feminism. I think we should just quickly look at the context. So it was beginning its third wave, but I think a lot of the misogyny came from a backlash to girl power of the late 90s and also a kind of Ladette culture where women were basically saying they could drink as much as men, they could be as independent as men, they could drink, drive, you know, they could do all the essentially like be like men on nights out. And I think a lot of the misogyny was in reaction to that. And also I think there was an obsession with women's vaginas because of the rise of the Brazilian wax.
Yeah.
Which then became a big thing when Carrie gets one on Sex and the City.
I was going to say, there's a whole Sex and the City episode when they go to Miami,
Then people were talking about vaginas all the time. And then that's how like all the upskirting conversation came about, when paps would start taking pictures under the skirts of celebrities, to the point where on Emma Watson's 18th birthday, she remembers paparazzi lying on the floor of the restaurant to get shots of her.
It is insane that that was literally legal until Gina Martin went and fucking did something about it.
Paris was upskirted so many times. And so was Lindsay and so was Britney. All three of them were upskirted multiple times in 2006, 2007, 2008.
Absolutely wild.
Anyway, so back to the press's treatment of these women. Do you feel like they were obsessed with Paris's body post-sex tape? Like, did they ask her loads of intrusive questions about her sex life?
Yeah, I mean, she was the punchline of every joke. Her sex life was literally a constant topic for humor, for public debate. She was made to feel so embarrassed. She's actually spoken about how post the sex tape, she actually was suicidal at one point. She said she just didn't want to live. I didn't want to be known like that. And I would never be who I could have been. And I think it was just this mortification, especially, as I say, coming from this kind of prim and proper family. But it was very interesting. Not only Tina Fey, other women would almost use it as a feminist badge to bash her. So I think women really wanted to make clear at that time that it was an almost feminist stance to hate Paris Hilton. So, for example, Blake Lively was once asked about like similarities between them being, I guess, blonde women. And she said that to liken them to each other was a really dumb thing. Sienna Miller bashed her about like, oh, I'm not someone that's just going to like get fame from making a sex tape. She was really like treated with so much derision. She was very much a kind of shamed woman. And women wanted to distance themselves from her. So her first memoir, and when I say memoir, I of course use that term lightly. There was lots of photos in there. Confessions of an Heiress, a tongue-in-cheek peek behind the pose. I remember getting that book and I was obsessed, and my mum could never understand it. My mum was like, I am literally despairing of feminism, that this is what young girls are interested in. Like, my mum hated Paris Hilton at that time. She felt that she was such a toxic role model for young girls, which in a way I guess she was, but in another, equally, when I look back, actually it wasn't Paris's own image that she'd overly sexualized and all the rest of it. It was the media framing of her.
Yes.
She's also said since in interviews as well that the tape has remained and will something that will hurt me for the rest of my life. It's always in there at the back of my mind. When it happened, people were so mean to me. The way I was spoken about on nightly talk shows in the media, to see things with my family, it was just heartbreaking.
It's just disgusting. And yeah, as we said in the Britney episode, this was very much still the lads mag era. Playboy was a massive deal then, and more like highbrow magazines such as Squire and GQ kind of started modeling themselves after Playboy.
Yes.
And becoming a lot more soft porny.
FHM vibes.
Yes, because they knew how well it did.
And Nuts, Loaded and Zoo were all doing incredibly well in that era.
And they had all these celebrities like Paris, Lindsay, Britney posing topless on their magazines.
Yeah.
So as you'll remember from the Britney episode, Rolling Stone was a huge culprit in its absolutely disgusting interviews with these young stars, Britney one in particular. Do you remember how disgusting that was? And yet again with Lindsay Lohan, in 2004, Mark Benelli interviewed her for the cover. And the opening line is, Lindsay Lohan has been 18 for just under a week when she tells me her breasts are real. I did not ask, gentlemen never do, though my reporting, discreet visual fact-checking, a goodbye hug, seems to confirm her statement. Are you saying that you, Mark Benelli, who I assume was in your 30s or 40s, hugged
her up,
Lindsay Lohan, who has just turned 18, to check her breasts?
I can't deal. It is so crazy how much culture has shifted. I will say, looking back on all of this, it feels like it must have been 50 years ago, not 20.
It is insane. And then he also asks, and I find this again, this constant trying to beat women down for men's mistakes. Do you remember how in the Diane Sawyer interview, she tries to make Britney feel bad for her breakup with Justin, even though he cheated on her? And similarly, Mark Benelli asks Lindsay, do you ever feel bad that your fame is having the side effect of making your dad's problems big news in the tabloids? I'm sorry, but your dad being a criminal has nothing to do with Lindsay.
Yeah.
Like, if he shouldn't have broken the law then, if he didn't want his problems to be on the news. And also, he courted the press himself considerably. He also says to her, what do you think about the way that girls in pop culture today, like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, and now you, have to make this shift from child star to sex symbol? And Lindsay goes, do you mean growing up in public? It's weird. But I don't think of myself as a sex symbol. It's weird that people call me that.
Yeah, why do you even have to make that shift? Again, it says so much about how we perceived women at that time in the public eye. Like, if you're not a child star, then you're a sex symbol.
Yes, exactly. And then he says, but you seem to be less coy than, say, Britney Spears, who'll be naked on the cover of a magazine but insists she's not using sex to sell her records. So you are imagining these young women to have far more autonomy than they do if they're being employed by a major label.
It's interesting how the young woman was always pitted as the problem.
Yes. And also even the phrasing less coy. The whole use of the word coy, I think, in this context is gross.
Yeah, really gross. What was quite interesting with Paris Hilton when she was compared to Nicole Richie as well, her co-star on The Simple Life, was that Paris was just less palatable, perhaps because of the sex tape, but also I think that people felt that Nicole Richie had this like wild child rock image, and so that they could like handle her being off the rails. So I'm going to get into the very public feud between Paris and Nicole next time, which was, let's just say, fanned by the press. I mean, they
Classic.
Play a crazy role in the next part of this story, do they not?
Yeah, guys, if you think what we've said today has been stomach turning, then wait until what we have left to tell you about the press and Paris and Lindsay and Britney in the next few years.
And Nicole Richie, I'll be getting into
all
of that. There are some feuds, there are some falls, it all gets very dramatic. So do tune in, and we will see you next time.
And make sure you rate, review and subscribe. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We really love to hear from you. And a rating on Spotify as well. And we'll drop a poll beneath the episode on Spotify. So do go check that out.
Love you guys.
Bye.